Hello and welcome to edition 401 of the Monocle Weekly. On Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Tom Edwards.
On this week's programme, Rodney Graham. We'll be speaking to the Canadian visual artist about his new career retrospective, That's Not Me, plus his new music collection, Gondoliers. He's a busy man, but he's found a little time for us.
We'll also meet Paul Keedwell, the psychiatrist, writer and urbanist, whose new book, Headspace, looks at how city living not only affects our personal surroundings, but also our wider worldview too.
And we'll be talking to Roberto Fonseca, the Cuban pianist spreading the musical message of his home country around the globe.
All that, plus Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan will be dropping in with some editorial bum notes. Is that bun notes? Either would be good. In the news, look ahead. And we'll spin some more tunes too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Andrew, I'm very much looking forward to today's show, but before we look ahead, why not look back? What has the last 7 days meant for you?
A few tears. No, it hasn't been. It's been, just think, 10 days ago we hadn't done the media summit. 1 week ago we had not danced our little feet off at the shindig for all our staff celebrating 10 years. Oh, head hurt the next day. Back in on the Saturday and Sunday to finish the next issue.
Heroic.
And then this week has been a little bit more tempered, but rather exciting too.
It's not had the sort of pedal to the metal frenzy, but it still has an intensity, a different kind of intensity perhaps.
Yes, and a few less wine glasses in my hand, but
that's
only
good.
Just.
That's good. And yeah, you tried to...
You're saying that's good because you're worried about my...
A little bit. It was only around 10 a.m. when I'd see you with your box of wine that I'd start to ask some challenging questions. And what a show today. We've got art and music and psychiatry. Everything you need, Andrew.
Well, we've got someone who could see him as the first patient. Should we bring him in? It's Henry Rhys Sheridan. Henry, oh Henry, blow away your job and rock. All right. Henry, oh Henry, blow away Texas hop. But how am I doing now? Everything is all right. Hi, Henry.
Hello, Andrew. Hello, Tom.
Always lovely to see you of a weekend.
Tom, I'm drinking a mint tea. Normally I might be enjoying a caffeinated beverage at this time, but in accordance with your sleep improvement prescription course...
Dr. Tom.
I have stopped drinking caffeine after midday and it's actually made a huge difference, so thanks.
It's a whisker past midday. Are you going to incorporate the other elements that I mentioned to you?
Run through them again.
So, quality pillows. Quality pillows, Henry. You're not allowed to compliment people anymore. Blackout blinds. So yeah. You're sleeping in complete darkness. Yeah. That's apparently critical. But caffeine, I think, is the... There was another one as well. But
and don't look at your phone before you go to sleep.
Oh, that's very important.
That was actually the big talking point, wasn't it?
No blue light. That's what they call it.
Apparently, it makes your brain think that it's the morning.
And your brain doesn't know what day of the week it is, far less what time of day at the best of times, Henry.
On the 14th of March, Angela Merkel, Donald Trump... Tete-a-tete, mano a chancellero in Washington, going at it for the first time since Trump was elected. Now, a lot obviously was made after Trump was elected about Angela Merkel's lukewarm, shall we say, response to that election. Her famous quote was that any close cooperation between the two countries must be on the basis of values of democracy, freedom, respect for the rule of law and human dignity, regardless of origin, skin colour, religion, gender, sexual orientation or political belief. It's the kind of sentiment that won her a special place, I think most commentators agree, in the heart of Barack Obama, Donald Trump's predecessor. And they are meeting up for the first time on the 14th of March. What do you think they're going to talk about?
I mean, it's almost impossible to second guess Mr. Trump, isn't it? But I like the fact that Mutti restated those values. And I bet she won't be holding his hand in the Rose Garden, will she? Our own PM.
Our own dear leader.
I'd really hope that she gives him a bit of a dressing down, but maybe that's too much to hope for.
He's a funny character because he met Justin Trudeau and they seem to have got on just fine. So I think a lot of it is huffery and puffery for his audience. And I bet that it would probably... pass off in a kind of almost amicable way.
It's apparently unlikely that they're going to have a joint press conference. So I think they're aware that, you know, things could potentially get fraught if they expose the meeting to the light of day and they're trying to keep a lid on the squid, so to speak. So, no, you're right. I think it probably will pass over as a fairly run-of-the-mill diplomatic meeting, but an important one nonetheless. And another European political story, a very important one, on the 15th of March, general election in the Netherlands. Now, obviously, there's a lot of concern about the popularity of the Party for Freedom, Geert Wilders' party, anti-immigrant party, which are polling very well, second in the polls. And there's some scepticism as to whether they're going to win, but they can pull it. Astonishingly, in the Netherlands, there are 28 different parties, quite remarkable for a country of that size. So government is always through coalition, and many of the main parties have refused to enter a coalition with Geert's party. But nonetheless, he's already shifted the tone of the debate around the election significantly, you know, towards his agenda. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of bums on the edge of seats among European officials on that night.
You know, everyone's got so used to the fact that these elections turn out not how you anticipate, that nobody dares guess them anymore. But you're right to say that nobody seems to want to go into a grand coalition with him. So that seems it will, in the end, keep him out of power. But yeah, it's a hint that this nation we think we know as dope-smoking, liberal, open, laid-back, is also the place of a huge, you know, concern over migration, a very strong rightward shift, and there's a bit of a rural, you know, city divide. And amazing, you know, that as we know through the work we've done at Monocle, you have a Muslim mayor running Rotterdam who is, you know, confounds, you know, political, putting in boxes, but also you have cities where, you know, the right wing are very, very strong. It's a very, very mixed old bag of Edam cheese and more.
And Tom, what do you think of the multi-party system as a bulwark against extremism, excuse me, looking around the world?
Oh, it's difficult, isn't it? Because it's always held up as a good way to be inclusive, but to ensure that if you have autocrats or
bizarre right-wingers,
that you keep them out of office. I kind of agree with what Andrew said. I mean, I don't know why it seems even more striking. It's like when you get right-wing parties coming out of Scandinavia. It seems like such a positive story. It's always seemed like such a progressive nation. If you look at social policy, it's been generations ahead. And it's, I don't know, maybe it's, is it more depressing then that the same kind of nationalist rhetoric, that same anxiety about migration can pervade the political classes there, as has happened here, as is happening in France, and as, of course, has happened in the United States? Well, maybe we should just, you know, maybe it's time to realise that actually there's no society that's completely immune to this, and we need to, the narratives around migration and assimilation and inclusivity need to grow up with it. But yeah, I do worry, and I worry again. You know, the pollsters and the experts tell us that he can't get into office, but you never know anymore. It's like Marine Le Pen in France. I do worry. Andrew, you said, you know, everyone's wrong. I've been super wrong about all of the key.
You're wrong most of the time about most things.
Exactly, and I don't know what to think about this. I will watch with sort of.
You can't even guess what he's going to have for lunch these days. But anyway, carry on.
And on the 17th of March, I'm sure you're going to have strong opinions about this. The World Happiness Report is going to be released ahead of World Happiness Day, UN World Happiness Day, on March the 20th. And I say UN just so you don't assume that this is being produced by some kind of spurious non-governmental organisation. Mm. It is actually something with serious weight behind it. So it's going to be the fourth such report and reflects, according to this press release, growing global interest in using happiness and subjective well-being as primary indicators of the quality of human development. Now, two interesting points that I want to bring up and perhaps we can discuss. So this year, for the first time, the World Happiness Report is going to give a special role, according to the website, to the measurement and consequences of inequality in the distribution of well-being among countries and regions. Now, apparently one of the findings is that people are happier living in societies where there is less inequality of happiness. Now, I can understand that being used in an economic model where, you know, I can understand why societies where there is less economic inequality, even if their GDP is lower than a country with greater economic inequality, well-being would be lower. But mapping that onto happiness, that would mean that people, like a nation of miserable sods, are more well-off? You can't win for losing, surely. I'm not sure how that would work.
The data seems to disprove that, Henry.
But I think it's quite hard to quantify these things. And also, I don't know, I'm not always convinced that their kind of way of working out if people are happy or not is really kind of justified.
Well, of course, we do famously the Monocle Quality of Life survey each year, which is a ranking of different cities based on, you know, a combination of quantitative and qualitative assessments. What's your assessment of other rankings that you've seen, the official rankings?
They're all less good than ours.
Well, there's a subjective element in ours as well, which we're upfront about. There are some things which, you know, you have to have a subjective view on, and you use your correspondents and people on the ground to judge those things. I think it's difficult when you say it's a purely scientific valuation of happiness. Now, interestingly, we're going to be speaking later in the show to a psychiatrist who talks about cities, and I've been reading his book over the last few days, and it's fascinating. He does talk about, are you happier if you live on the ground floor of a building or on the seventh floor of a building? Are you happy or less happy because of the materials around you? So there's all these things coming into play. Definitely there are some places, countries, streets, types of people that are more happy than others. But it's also within the same city and the same context. You know, are people culturally the same levels of happiness, whether you're, you know, poor, rich, you know, young, old, Jewish, Muslim? You know, it depends on all the experiences you're having at that time. I think it's very hard to put a figure on and say, British people are this happy on a chart. And I know for myself, you know, I'm not the same as level of happiness on a Monday and a Friday. Friday, way, hey, hey!
Oh, I was going to say, we don't need to drill down anymore into which of those is at the right end of the spectrum. Monocle's Henry Sheridan, thanks for bringing a little happiness here to Studio One.
The term genre-defying is a much overused expression, but the multifaceted work of Vancouver artist Rodney Graham might loosely fit that remit. Or it would, if we could keep up.
Rodney has a new career retrospective at the Baltic Contemporary Arts Centre in Newcastle, here in the UK, named That's Not Me. It collects many of his most significant works that include photography, painting, sculpture and video from the past 30 years. Graham's work draws inspiration from influences ranging from Sigmund Freud to Kurt Cobain, uniting high-minded art theory with everyday pop culture. And he's been creating his own pop culture too, literally. Rodney also has a brand new album named Gondoliers, produced in collaboration with the Vinyl Factory here in London.
We'll be talking to Rodney in just a moment, but let's hear now a track from that new album. This is Getting Out of Downtown.
Who am I anyway? What's it all about? I could use a getaway to figure this stuff out. Switching on the GPS, destination way out west. I'm getting out of downtown. Yeah, I'm getting out of downtown.
That's the strains of getting out of town. Rodney Graham joins us in the studio right now. Rodney, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Wonderful to have you with us. Now, we were sort of talking about, I mean, Andrew mentioned there, genre-defying, and you've got this amazing retrospective and the new record. Does it matter, do you think, how people perceive you and your work? Or do you just say, look, I'm an artist, here's what I do, you know, view some of it, listen to it? Or does it matter to you how people, I don't know, pigeonhole people?
I guess it doesn't really matter. I mean, for one thing, the music is kind of a hobby. It's not part of my art practice. I treat it kind of differently because it's not something that I do as a professional. But other than that, I mean, my work, I guess I started as kind of a conceptual artist, doing work with text and kind of conceptual photography. And then I kind of moved on. At a certain point, I had a bit of a crisis and decided to do things that were a little bit more, had less of a backstory, more immediate, something that people could read on different, you know, start on a simpler level and move to a deeper level if that was, you know, the case. But No, I'm happy with, you know, to be a, I suppose, an artist working in different media.
And Rodney, tell us a little bit about the show that you're doing at the Baltic. When we look back through much of the work you've done, there is a lot of you acting parts, appearing in your own photographs, amazingly put together images where you appear as a cowboy, an artist. Is this show a continuation of that work, which is that strange split to being the artist but also appearing in your art?
Yeah, I guess I started appearing in my work as a performer, I guess, in the mid-90s with a piece called Halcyon Sleep, where it was a performance where I took a double dose of the sedative Halcyon in a motel in the outskirts of town and had my brother and a friend pick me up and put me in the back of a car and take me home. And the video just shows me sleeping in the back of a car. It was a piece that came at a time when I wanted to make a change in my work, and it was a relatively easy performance to do, and that kind of led to a number of performances using myself. It was like kind of a bit of a breakthrough for me. And again, it was an attempt to kind of create a more accessible work, you know, than what I had been doing, which is text-based work that had often an elaborate explanation, behind it.
And is that playing with identity something that you're throwing back at the audience as well, saying, you know, who are you? What parts do you play in your life as well?
I guess it's more, in a way, I suppose that's implied, but it's more about, I suppose, my own personality and ability to get a grip on what I actually am. I suppose that's one of the reasons I came to art. You know, I could deal with those issues.
And perhaps, sorry, Tom, but a contemporary of yours, someone like Cindy Sherman, there is this history of photography artists trying to play with their identity by putting themselves in the image. Is that a kind of a theme that you see in the art world, that this not knowing what side of the lens to be on?
I kind of partly got into it to do photographic work that was different and to differentiate myself from contemporaries like and people who are my teachers and big influences like Jeff Wall, Ian Wallace in Vancouver, Stan Douglas, people who took this sort of directorial position, creating photographs or films from the position of a director and directing people. I prefer to be kind of directed myself as part of just maybe kind of a passive aspect of my personality. I like to create a kind of situation where, now, that's part of the reason I use myself, I guess, because I don't like actually being a director, so I'd rather have somebody else do that.
Rodney, it's interesting what you said there. I wondered about how people engage with the work when they are viewing it. Is that interesting for you? If you see, I don't know, this big show then at the Baltic, are you intrigued by what the natives or visitors there, how they engage with the work, how they look at it? Is it yeah, very different from market to market? I mean, is that?
Yeah, it's always interesting to see how people receive things in different places. And I think that the work is open enough, and I've tried to create it, something that's open enough that can be kind of approached by different people at different times in different places with some level of understanding. And then there's maybe a deeper level that can be probed. Mm.
On the planning side, a banal question popped through my mind when I saw your work. And you look at the Baltic, huge spaces in which you can show your work. When the call comes through and they're like, Rodney, we want you to do a show, is there a bit of you which is, can someone with a tape measure quickly run yeah, around the gallery and tell yeah, me how big it is?
Exactly. I mean, there's such a trend now to very large spaces. It can be really overwhelming for people who don't work at a large scale. And there's a kind of... And the Baltic space, especially the top floor, is a very big, big open space. And it was a bit of a challenge to deal with. And for that, I'm showing a bunch of film works that are kind of some of which are projected quite large. And then the floor below is mostly light boxes, photographic work, and some text-based works. But yeah, I mean, there is this trend towards large spaces that's challenging, to say the least.
And in the preparation of the work for a space like that, you know, just tell us a little bit of the work that in the ramp. Do you have to come over and see the location several times? Are you there for the installation?
I did, yeah. I'm working with Alessandro Vincentelli, the curator at the Baltic, and he had me up and last year, and I saw the space. And as I say, and you pointed out, I was a little bit taken aback by the scale. And I worked with him. We made a model of the space and models of my works. I always make a model. It helps, a physical model, not like a SketchUp model or on the computer, but actually a physical model. And so that helps.
I wanted to ask a bit more. I know you sort of Well, I was asking about, you know, how I guess you define yourself as an artist and whether the music is part of that. And you've said it's a sort of a hobby. Is it a question of, I don't know, I mean, I'm just interested in like the boundaries of creative expression, if you like. So do you have your visual artist hat on and then maybe you relax and maybe write some music or play music with friends or with the band? Or, I don't know, does the creativity come from the same place? Maybe it's a stupid question. I don't know.
No, it isn't at all. I'd done music when I was younger, and I always had kind of ambitions and to be a musician. And I did put it aside for a long time when I kind of worked on my career. It was kind of necessary. And then I kind of returned to it in the late 90s with it. And it became a kind of a serious, it's something I do compulsively every day. I try to, writing songs is extremely difficult for me. I have problems with lyrics. But I spend at least an hour or two a day just attempting to write a song, struggling through it. The technique of guitar gives me a kind of hands-on thing that I don't really have with my artwork. And so it's an important, but I still call it a hobby because it really is something that I do kind of on the side. It doesn't really intersect. There's a few pieces I've done where I've used music, my music in my work, but it's not something I do a lot, and I find that very difficult to integrate the two.
There's a Vancouver school of art and artists, which you know, you're loosely connected with. Mm-hmm. What makes Vancouver an art city? What it could be, because it's interesting. There's great writers there. There's all sorts of creativity. Why is Vancouver, you know, the home for so much art in Canada?
Hard to say again, but I came out of, a certain generation that was, I guess, influenced by very powerful teachers of just a few years older than me. Ian Wallace and Jeff Wall. I was a student of Ian Wallace at the University of British Columbia, and then later with Jeff Wall, and they, of course, became friends and colleagues. But I suppose at the time, in the late 60s, early 70s, there was something about the distance from the main art centers like New York that kind of created a different perspective, and we got everything from art magazines and not from really direct contact. And then later there was more of an exchange with teachers like Ian and Jeff brought people in from New York, like Dan Graham or...
Just tell me, an addendum to that, you know, what makes it a school, as it were, rather than just like, you know, quite a nice scene? Is it, do you have contact with each other? Do you feel that you're socially connected as well?
Schools, obviously that's something that a term that somebody else would have applied. Yeah. We didn't come up with that ourselves. But I mean, it was a very close-knit group of the so-called Vancouver School. These people were all working within photography. And even though I never really considered myself, and I still don't consider myself a photographer, actually, I'm different from some other people in that respect. I mean, I don't even own a camera. I don't do the photographs myself. I work with a crew, and I'm using more of the, I always kind of think of myself as an actor producer. I always evoke Tom Cruise or something.
I was just about to say. But what about,
just about to say.
If not, Vancouver School. What about if we take a further step back and look at you as a Canadian artist? And of course, your work you've literally represented Canada at in Venice, of course, back in the 90s. And am I right in saying some of your works appeared on postage stamps, is that right, in Canada as well?
Oh, yes, actually, yeah.
Is that funny as an artist when you suddenly see that, you know, the nation's... it's a responsibility of the nation is on your shoulders.
That's really funny. I'm glad you mentioned that because it gives me an opportunity to mention that. I also have a show at Canada House in London. It's a small exhibition in the Canadian consulate. And we're actually, one of the works on exhibition is that stamp. Kind of funny because... It was made as part of a series of photographers, Canadian photographers, a few years ago, work of Canadian photographers. But it's great because I actually get to be on the stamp since I took photographs of myself. And there's even a little picture of my mother somewhere in there, too, as a photograph within a photograph. But, that's...
It would be nice to have had that framed up for the Baltic. Put that in one of the big rooms. Where is his work? I can't see Rodney's work.
Yeah, right, yeah, yeah.
Now, another thing, you know, being a polymath, you've also got a cafe. How did that come about?
Shannon and Scott from my studio, my studio managers, and I, we live in the same neighborhood near Main Street in Vancouver, and it was a local bakery called Liberty Cafe that was, the baker was just in his 90s and was deciding to time to retire, and we had the opportunity to buy it at a really quite cheap rate. So, and their kids, Shannon and Scott's kids, had been going there every day for years, and so we just thought we would just try to keep it going. So we've done that. We just redecorated it and had a new baker and kind of rejigged it. But it's fun, but it's not a profitable enterprise.
But you can cater your own openings.
Yeah, I eat there every day, breakfast, lunch.
That's good. Well, and Ronnie, what about where all of these things meet? So, I mean, for example, we're sitting here with the beautiful LP is here, with Gondoliers, and it's a sort of, it's a pretty interesting one to look at. Tell me about the artwork, because I guess that's interesting. We've talked actually on this program recently about artists designing record covers. And I guess you're an artist and you have a record like, that must be quite exciting, isn't it? When you can start off and you can kind of take it anywhere. What's that process like?
It's fun. I always like to do my own album covers, and I feel a responsibility since I am an artist. One would, would expect that I would do that. the covers are made up of a bunch of collages from an old, when Scott, again, from my studio, had found a bunch of old circus magazines, this American rock magazine. Does it still exist? I don't know. From the mid-80s. Mm. And I just took a bunch of, I was just struck by all these images of Motley Crue and various kind of hair metal bands, kind of absurd, absolute nadir of like male presentation in terms of fashion. And I did a series of collages with those in a kind of Rauschenberg-y kind of way. And actually, those, what you're looking at are details of some quite large paintings, sometimes 10 feet. And so I did that. And then the label is, like a fan pin from the from the 60s, dedicated to the Dave Clark Five, because there's a song about the Dave Clark Five, a London band.
Rodney, I think both me and Tom feel a little bit kind of one string ponies here. But the album is called Gondoliers and it's out now. And you can head over to thevinylfactory.com for more details. And Rodney Graham's retrospective, That's Not Me, is at the Baltic Arts Centre in Newcastle until June. And as you've heard, there's a show about his stamps and much more at Canada House here in London too. And you're listening to the Monocle Weekly.
So, Andrew, should we play another one of Rodney's tracks next up in the show?
Oh, yes.
Let's hear this one. This is from Gondoliers. It's Old Dave Clark.
Drummer.
Well, that was Rodney Graham there with Old Dave Clark, and it's from the album Gondoliers, and you're listening to the Monocle Weekly. Building livable cities is a constant tug of war between form and function. So how do we best design our cities to feel good to be in?
Well, Dr. Paul Keedwell is a psychiatrist and researcher for Cardiff University, and his new book looks to address how architecture and city planning affects our outlook. The book is called Headspace: The Psychology of City Living. A little earlier, he sat down with Andrew to tell him more about it.
Paul, thank you for coming to see us. Now,
it's a pleasure.
The first thing I want to quiz you about is that, you know, we see our cities changing as we recognise we need more density. We have to pack more people in. We're having increasing numbers of high-rises. Are high-rises good for us?
I think the simple answer is it depends. But if you were to look at the body of research in general, I would be tempted to say no. It depends, because it depends on the individual and their demographic, but it also depends importantly on design. And I think a lot of our high-rise buildings are thrown up without any consideration of the psychological impact of these buildings on the people that live in them.
Now, your book pulls on lots of great research, and just on this topic, you look at two interesting studies, one in New York that showed whether people lived in low-rise or high-rise. You could tell whether people were going to be happy or not almost by how high up they lived off the ground.
Yeah.
And also a project in Singapore where they looked at suicide rates, and actually the taller the buildings got, the more people there were who felt they might want to jump off them.
That's right, because they had a, if you like, a sort of natural follow-up study there, because they, you know, there was a rapid increase in the number of high-rise properties built, you know, over a period of 20 years. And so they're able to compare suicide rates before and afterwards, you know, and being careful to compare, you know, the effects for the same types of people that had been rehoused from the traditional kampong villages to these high-rises.
And what can we do to mitigate against that? You're talking about the psychology, but what can the people you're talking to, the architects and the urban planners, what can they do to make those buildings better then?
I mean, I'm not sure with regard to suicide if there's much you can do, because of that link between ready access to a lethal means of killing yourself and suicide rates.
But general well-being.
But in general well-being, one of the main problems is the higher you live up from the street, the less you're connected with the street and the less exercise you do. And I think it's important, therefore, to make the connection with the street as strong as possible, not have build high rises that are sort of isolated from the rest of the city. That's one thing. The other thing is to, traditionally, I think high rises have been built without any private personal spaces provided, and a lot of sort of open parkland that isn't owned by anybody and can foster crime and so on. So it's about providing some personal outside space, and some of the best modern architecture high rises now seem to have these sky gardens built in. They also have more space within the building for sort of meeting other people, breaking off into conversation and so on. A lot of the early high-rises were built cheaply. Communal areas were not sufficient, and the lines of sight were not sufficient, so you couldn't necessarily see easy ways out of corridors. There were lots of hidden spaces where crime could proliferate and so on.
Now, before we dive into more examples, just tell me, this book, how did it come about? Why? What made you feel that there was time for a book about the psychology of the city?
It was due to my own study, really, on the history of architecture in the 20th century. And it occurred to me that there was a lot of interesting research from the sort of 1980s and early 1990s that had been done. But there was a need for people to sort of return to this research, I thought, given the fact that more and more of us are living in cities, and more of us who live in cities are becoming depressed and anxious and so on. And a major factor in that, in whether we become stressed and depressed, is the environment.
And tell me, the psychology of the city, when I was reading your book, it struck me that even the examples you're often given, you know, even celebrated urbanists like Jane Jacobs, who famously fought to make sure that Manhattan didn't just become a big highway, but and fought Robert Moses. But there you're talking about somebody who cared about the city and kind of maybe in the background had an intuitive understanding of what maybe people feel connected and community. But she wasn't really talking about psychology. When did this notion of, you know, the pure psychology of actually, does this building make people feel good or bad? Does this park make people good or bad? How long has that been around?
I think since about the late 1960s and going into the 70s, I'd say the heyday of environmental psychology was 1980s. I mean, one of the pioneers was a chap called Roger Ulrich, who showed in a famous hospital study that if you were a patient in a bed by a window with a view of nature as opposed to by a wall, you tended to recover more quickly, need fewer painkillers, and there's a sort of lower rate of readmission as well. So this idea of the need for us to have some contact with nature within an urban environment being important. And from a lot of this work, town planners are realising that even small bits of planting can make a big difference to stress levels.
Because your book is amazing on the connection between human happiness, green space, human happiness, and even a dash of water. You know, you don't have to have a kind of a lake or a sea to look out. Just small water features also,
yes,
can change our moods.
Yes, and having some water in a sort of concrete environment can make that environment almost as pleasurable to be in as, you know, a rural environment.
But when you walk around the city, any city, we're based here in London, do you see new developments and recognise immediately that something's gone right or wrong? Can you think, OK, I can see that this is not going to be a place where people feel comfortable, where people will want to linger?
Yeah. Well, obviously high-rises are back in London. There's a concern that it's going to turn into Dubai by Thames because of the number of high-rises that have been signed off under Boris Johnson's tenureship as mayor. And I think it's now accepted, largely as a result of the efforts of environmental psychologists, that high-rise living is totally unsuitable for families. One study, I think it was of some army accommodation in Germany, being if couples with small children were put even just a story or two stories above the ground, they complained of mental health problems much more than people who were families that are on ground floor. So it's important to have that area of open space where children can play and be easily supervised. And that's obviously denied to you when all we've got is a small balcony.
I mean, you talk about, you know, glass and materials. Do you think that the things that surround us have an impact on how we feel as well? You know, it's, you know, whether you're in a brick space or you're in a timber space or a glass space, do the materials impact on our well-being as well?
Yeah, materials and colours. Not just in the interior, though. I think it's critically important for us to push back against the clean lines, the plain monolithic buildings of, I suppose, modernism, which modernism was about getting rid of decoration and adornment. But actually, what makes us happy is a vista of the built environment that has some complexity. If the buildings themselves, the facades, don't offer that, like, I mean, arguably, the Georgian and Victorian terraces, the best examples anyway, in London, are providing that pleasant visual complexity. And that's what people appreciate, I think, who visit from around the world. But if we just have bland monolithic structures, we can at least try to break up the facades by planting trees and so on and creating a bit of complexity and mystery. Within the house, I mean, you asked specifically about building materials. Yeah, sure. London stock brick, much easier on the eye than a black monochrome brick or any monochrome brick. It's the idea of visual interest and warmth. Natural materials, woods, although, you know, steel can work well. But there's a whole bunch of evidence that just painting your wall green can make a difference to your well-being. So this idea of representing nature somehow through materials in your home.
Sorry, just dive in. We've dwelled on the domestic environment, but tell me, in your work environment,
yeah,
it was interesting lots of research onto whether the open plan office is good for you, whether you should be better off working in a cubicle. Now, we here at Monocle, we have a on my floor with all the editorial team, it's properly open plan. There's a bit of noise, but you know, I feel connected to everything that's going on. Mm. I was surprised to read that actually most people feel that that's not good for you, that the open plan, you know, you should have some barrier, that you should have an escape route almost.
The most modern answers to this question are trying to deal with the psychology, the environmental psychology evidence, which in general shows if you're plonked in an open plan office, you are disturbed by noise and you resent the lack of privacy. That's the average person. If you're very good at blocking out extraneous noise, which I am actually, when I'm focused on something, it's almost too much. You know, I can have firecrackers going on beside me and not notice. But that isn't, and in fact, the research says that if you're like that, if you're a good person, a good filterer of the sensorium, if you like, the environment, then you're kind of okay. But if you're sensitive to noise, then you're not okay. And then I suppose there's a middle ground where most of us are, where we're a bit disturbed by it. And the solution is often just careful design of baffling, just having baffles and soft furnishings, things that can absorb a lot of the noise going on around you, so that you can have conversations with people when you want to without overhearing other people's conversations and so on and so forth. Is it enough just to have the sound baffling? It depends. I think what you don't want is to have unscheduled interruptions of important meetings that you're having, or you don't want someone coming over and having an unwelcome conversation with you when you're trying to focus on something else. So having breakaway spaces seems to be the solution that a lot of modern companies have now. So they have a mixture of open plan and more private and semi-private spaces.
And finally, tell me, there's a quote in the book, I may be misquoting him slightly, from the architect Rem Koolhaas, who kind of says, you know, human beings, they're going to be miserable sods, whether in good architecture, bad architecture. It's not the buildings that matter, it's the human beings. I think you take a different opinion. Do you think this is a book that all architects should read before they start putting pencil to paper or kind of mouse to keyboard or whatever?
Yes, I do. I disagree with him entirely. Yeah, I think he said that people can be miserable in anything or ecstatic in anything, and increasingly he thought architecture had nothing to do with it. But I think that's not borne out by the research that I've quoted in this book.
Well, it's a properly glorious book, and I would
very kind of you.
Thank you, and I recommend anyone buy it. It's called Headspace: The Psychology of City Living, and it's by Dr. Paul Kidwell.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. We'll be talking Cuban music and culture after this.
Roberto Fonseca is a Cuban pianist who's toured with the country's greats, such as Ibrahim Ferrer of the Buena Vista Social Club, and has created a run of celebrated albums of his own, bringing his brand of Latin jazz to wider audiences. He'll play a show at London's Barbican tomorrow night, for those lucky enough to be nearby. His latest record is Abuk, which distills some of the biggest flavours found in Cuban music into one listen.
We'll be talking to Roberto in just a moment. But first, here he is with Mambo Afro from that recent record. Ouch. That's Roberto and his band there. And Roberto, I'm delighted to say, joins us now. Roberto, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Great to have you with us. It's amazing. There's not too many records where you can hear just a second and it completely transports you and takes you. I'm sure you're bored of people saying that. But it's amazing how potent the music, I don't know, of Cuba is. And I guess you had no choice. Your family of musicians.
No.
Music was your life from when you were a tiny baby. Could you ever have been anything else other than a musician, do you think?
No, I mean, I was, all the time I was in music. I was trying to play baseball and football when I was a child, but all the time I returned to music. Yeah, for me, being musical, having a musical background or having musical family, whatever, was really good for me. I learned a lot of things. I'm still learning a lot of things from my family. And my family is my big support. So that's why I'm the person, I'm the musician that I am now. Yeah, because of that. All the time music, I don't know if I can do. Maybe I do. But I don't want to to try to do another thing.
Even baseball? Even if you have a chance? No way.
Okay. Music is my thing, yeah.
Because your mum even works with you on some of the records. What's it like? Because in a way, you imagine music being a type of revolt often for a youngster, kind of like, I want to do my own thing and go away. But how much, you know, how much has your parents played a part in your career?
The most biggest and the most important part of my career, you know. Even when I was a student, I was a bad student because I was playing baseball, football, you know. When I was supposed to study piano. But my mom supported me to go to play baseball, you know. I was hired from my father, and she was supporting me. But at the same time, she was my family supported me a lot to give me a lot of information, to give me a lot of, they took me through different type of music. That's why the person that I am now, because of that, because I grew up with different type of music, or like classical music, African music, funky music, rock music. And the time I was really like a rock and roller player or heavy metal player, you know. And they support me all the time because they feel it and they saw that I was really into the music. Sometimes I give them a heart attack with the school. But, you know, you are a kid, you know, supposed to play at the same time, yeah.
Tell us a bit about the musical history of Cuba, I suppose, because I know in this record, and I guess it's in a lot of your work, is a bit about joining the dots back through history, whether it's going back to the 40s sound, that big band sound, or later or earlier. Do you just kind of find almost by reflex that you do that? You pick up on these historical strands, or is it something you try and do quite particularly?
No, I try those style particularly, but at the same time when we was doing the research for making the album, I found, and I'm ashamed today to say this, I found that in Cuba we have a really huge different things about music, you know. But it's impossible to put all those things on the album. So then we decided to take the most representative style, and then we put it. And yeah, I'm really happy, and then how those songs sounds, and then, yeah, but it was difficult. It was really difficult.
And the significance of the album's name, Abuk, which is obviously Cuba backwards, is this a journey through Cuban music in the wrong direction?
The wrong direction? No
way.
A
different direction.
Yeah, not the wrong direction. I mean, I'm like the title of the album saying, I'm trying to show the Cuban music history from the time before, from now, you know. And from my point of view, you know, that because I have a lot of influence, different influence. So I put that scene on the songs. But that's the main thing on the album, trying to guide people on the Cuban music. Yeah.
And tell us, it's a really interesting thing for people who haven't lived in Cuba, don't know Cuba very well. There's an amazing sense of Cuban artists, whether it's painters, dancers, you know, here in the UK, especially we know Carlos Acosta so well, you know, these amazing Cuban artists who are international, traveling the world. You were for a little time with the Buena Vista Social Club, traveling the world. Very kind of outward in the arts world, but we never quite understand the split between Cuba, you know, being cut off from America in many senses, cut off from lots of things, but so open as well. When you're sitting in Cuba working as an artist, is that a bit of a split, a bit of a dichotomy that you know that you're internationally focused and you're very Cuban at the same time? What's that split between being outward looking and taking in all these inspirations and sitting at home as well?
Well, sitting at home, beautiful thing in Cuba, sometimes you in Cuba you feel like you are not in Cuba, you know. That's why Cuba have a lot of influence from different culture. You know, we have Chinese, we have French people, we have England people, we have Russian people. And that sometimes don't make you feel like you are only Cuban, you know. Cuban is a result of different things, you know. But at the same time, Cuban thing is very important because our traditional Cuban music, you know. So thinking of playing international way, but at the same time being Cuba is not difficult.
But this moment of change that we keep on hearing talked about for Cuba, does that play out in the music too, in the way that you...
No, change about, you're saying, life? You're saying?
Yeah, about life and politics and, you know, whether Cuba will be more open to outside influences again. I wondered if that fed through into the cultural world.
You know
well.
What? There are people, they have this kind of thought or they have kind of thing in mind that people is more open now. Cuba is not more open. We are being open all the time. So let's maybe is the world is open to Cuba? That's the thing, you know? Because we always were welcome to all the guys. That's why I'm telling you, we have Chinese people, we have Russian, we have England people. So that means that Cuba is open to the world. But the political things is really like another career. It's like a musician, they're a career. So they only they know how they can handle the things, you know? Okay. So Cuba is open. And maybe the world want to see more Cuban things, you know? That's maybe big change. People are thinking, you know what, I need to go to Cuba now because before the big change. No way. Won't be a big change. Maybe you will see a lot of tourists. That's maybe one thing. But won't be a big change because we are a group that we are taking care about the Cuban culture, you know.
So maybe politics. That could still be another career.
No way, not politics.
You talk pretty well. It's funny though. What struck me, you're talking about all the international people who are interested in Cuban culture. What about when you travel around with your music? I know you've got a big show at the Barbican, I think, in London. You've played all around the world. How different are we? Are the English audience a bit quiet, a bit reserved?
You know,
I see you're laughing. But is that true? Do you ever get surprised? Because we were talking earlier in the program about how people view art differently in different places. Is that been your experience?
I mean, yeah, definitely. You will feel some audience more warm than the other one, you know. And sometimes there are some cliches. That's normal. I mean, when you go to some places, I have to say he in England or in France, you know, even in Cuba, that's happening in all the places. Sometimes the promoters say, you know what, this is English people. So English people, they do this. But then you start to play like in a way, but then you realize that they don't think that they're English. You know,
so it's the same language almost of the music once you get going.
Yeah, I mean, they became crazy, I can tell you, on all the places that
I've been. Even at the Barbican.
I'm telling you.
They can be the craziest
places. Yeah, yeah, on the places.
So do you have favourites? I mean, are there places, I don't think, Andrew was saying about you've toured, I mean, what, hundreds of concerts all around the world? No,
I don't have favourites. That's why. Because, I mean, sometimes you're expecting a warm audience and it's not warm like
Tell us where that happened. I'm very upset about that.
No way.
We'll leave that one to find out another day.
Okay.
So what about the looking ahead? Obviously, this record is pretty new. Are you already thinking about recording again? Is it about touring? How do you kind of plan what you want to do next?
Well, always I'm composing, always. For me, one of the most difficult things is to select the songs for the album, because when I was recording a book, I had already a song for music for two more albums, you know. And then, because I get a lot of inspiration, and then I'm trying to put that inspiration on music. And of course, I have a plan to record. I'm asking to the manager, do you need to go already to the studio? Say, no, take a break. the album come out in November, so.
And tell me, your music has also appeared in films and has had, you know, a life beyond the recording studio. How exciting is that when it gets picked up by somebody else and used in different ways?
That's amazing. That's a bless. I mean, for me, especially when they put on the film, because for me to compose, I create the film, little film in my mind, and then I do the music, you know. So because music has to tell something, to tell a story, to tell something, you know. And when I know that someone is using my music for a film or for theater or whatever, I say, well, that's really cool. I mean, I have to keep going. I mean, I have to keep the music fresh. Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, Roberto, more power to you. Enjoy your gigs in London. They'll be very enthusiastically.
Cool. That's it.
I'm sure. That's it. It's fast and furious.
I'm kidding. That's it.
When I feel, because you could just, I don't want to detain you in the studio, because I feel you could compose something quickly on your way wherever you're going next. So.
I mean, yeah, I can compose. I have a little tiny keyboard on my back, and then I compose everywhere, places. Yeah,
this is incredible. Compose something. Compose us a little Monocle tune
on the road.
I'm gonna do it.
Send it back to us.
Okay, but you have to sing it. Right?
Okay. I will. I've got a beautiful voice.
Okay, good. That's good. Okay.
Lovely stuff, Roberto Fonseca. It's an absolute pleasure to meet you.
Thanks
so much for coming to see us.
Thank you.
Well,
Well, Andrew, that is just about all we have time for on this 401st edition of the Monocle Weekly. Quite the show.
Yeah, great. And I know I did one of those chats on my own, but I think it's really fascinating, somebody who's done, you know, the psychology of the city. It's something we've tried to delve into quite a lot over the years at Monocle. But this is the first book that I've read that really kind of takes you around the city in a really kind of open, friendly way and discusses all these small things and how they impact on your life. And who knew that a splashing fountain could actually change your mood? Well, it does.
it did, and it does. Let's thank the team behind the glass, as always. Today's programme was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Antia Longo, our studio manager. As ever, was Claire Arban. The Monocle Weekly will, of course, be back again next week. Who knows, though, Andrew, who'll be in the chairs? It may be me. It may be you.
I think it might be me, actually. We'll see.
From me, Tom Edwards, though, for this week.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
It's goodbye. Thanks for listening.